Okay, as the note on the blackboard indicates, I won't be doing my weekly Q&A at 4 o'clock today. But we will have one next week, which will be, as it turns out, the last one before the exam. So 2 weeks from today, we have an exam. Fun. Okay. Any preliminary questions, issues? Short answer is no. I mean, you can bring it, you just can't look at it. Well, what I've done for the second semester exam in May is to include as part of the exam an appendix that has the little sort of miniaturized tort tree outline. So, but that's a long time away. But all my exams are closed book from the standpoint that you don't bring anything or you don't use anything in the course of the exam that's not provided to you in the exam. Does that make sense? Yes, ma'am. Oh. Someplace, I thought there was a Microsoft Word file that has each of the pages in a just in a Microsoft Word document, and you can essentially print that all off. I think that's out there someplace. I thought I stuck it on the CD. I'll put it on the website. Within the visual outline section. So if you go there, you can find it. Other preliminary questions or issues? Okay. Well, we finished on Wednesday with the exploration of Helling versus Carey and trying to identify the distinction between a rule of reasonable care that requires a plaintiff to establish negligence in order to recover, as opposed to a rule of strict liability, which allows the plaintiff to recover because for one reason or another, the court believes that the defendant's activity is subject to strict liability. What we really didn't, except in sort of an elliptical way, consider was, okay, well, how do you decide which rule to apply? Obviously, it would be the plaintiff's preference to have a rule of strict liability, lowering the threshold for recovery, and the defendant, in a reciprocal way, would like to would never want a rule of strict liability, but would prefer a rule that required the plaintiff to meet a more difficult burden of showing that the defendant behaved negligently. So to get at that question, at least in one area of how courts decide which rule to apply, we look at this Sigler versus Kuhlman case. Ms. Wisely, can you tell us about Sigler versus Kuhlman? Yeah, if you can, yeah. You're in the middle of digesting your lunch there, I say, so yeah, yeah. Okay, so the plaintiffs, in this case, the plaintiff being the estate of Carol House, seeking compensation for her wrongful death, whom do they sue? Okay, the people that were transporting the gasoline. And what was their basis for asking the court to award them compensation? What legal theory supported that? Yeah, The plaintiff said that the defendant was negligent in transporting the gasoline. That's why this fire and catastrophe erupted. How did the plaintiff propose to establish negligence on the part of the defendant? That's what the plaintiff should have argued, but they didn't. In fact, what the plaintiff used as a basis of establishing negligence, again, my question was, how did the plaintiff want to establish negligence? And your answer was essentially how they could have established something different, namely strict liability. But the plaintiff was fixated on this idea of negligence, and to get a finding of negligence, they proposed what? True. And again, just sort of by way of review, exam preparation and so forth, I go back to my analogy. You run a plumbing business, so you've got a truck full of, you know, odds and ends. You encounter a problem here, you look at the house, you see here's a plumbing problem. What in my truck can I find that would give me leverage on this problem? What tricks do I have up my sleeve to get the jury to a finding of negligence in this case? Res ipsa loquitur, yeah. Again, what about res ipsa seems to apply to this case? Okay, that would sort of go to element number one. Just as we sort of look at the accident, not unlike Judson versus Giant Powder, you know, you have this mushroom cloud over the accident scene. Whatever evidence there might have been about the truck is probably severely damaged, if not obliterated, by this huge fire and explosion. Moreover, as you were saying, looking at an accident like this, you would say to yourself, a well-run tanker operation doesn't ordinarily result in overturning and spilling all this gasoline. At least that doesn't happen when people are using reasonable care. We can infer, can we not, that res ipsa loquitur, the thing speaks for itself. Doesn't the happening of the accident suggest that the defendant was negligent? Okay, so that's the plaintiff's theory. How does the trial judge react to the plaintiff's request that the jury be instructed on res ipsa that be the way that the plaintiff can prove negligence? How does the trial judge react? Did the trial judge instruct the jury on res ipsa? Actually, they did. Yeah, they did instruct the jury on res ipsa. But what did the jury do? Yes. Now, remember that this is the way in which res ipsa is a tool, a means of getting to this finding of negligence, but the fact that the trial judge finds, yes, I think you've met all three elements of a res ipsa claim, I will instruct the jury on res ipsa and allow them to make this inference, that doesn't mean we're putting a gun to the jury's head and telling them they have to find negligence. Apparently, there was enough evidence in this case that persuaded the jury that this accident happened without negligence on the part of the defendant. Some other cause, maybe a defect in the tanker itself, the people who manufactured the tanker, maybe something else caused. They don't really know, and the jury is simply not convinced. If you ask us, do we think more probably than not, did the defendant caused this accident by the defendant's negligence? We think not. So said the jury. Now, the plaintiff filed an appeal. And what was the basis of the plaintiff's appeal? Again, going back to sort of basics as far as what the appealing party has to establish in an appeal, we have to find there's some error by the trial court. According to the plaintiff, what error did the trial judge commit? Well, there's some question about that. I can't recall what, if anything, the trial judge did about contributory negligence, but I think the plaintiff's argument was focused more on the technicalities of the way the jury was instructed on res ipsa. It may have been that the trial judge required the plaintiff to bear the burden of persuasion, the risk of non-persuasion, as we say, such that the plaintiff was or the jury was told, in effect, it's the plaintiff's burden to prove negligence. You can use res ipsa to get there, but you still have to be convinced that the plaintiff was negligent. By contrast, some, as I think I mentioned earlier in the notes, some jurisdictions say that it's that once the finding is made that the res ipsa doctrine applies, the burden actually shifts to the defendant, and it's now the defendant's job to show that the defendant used reasonable care, and the plaintiff is in the sort of defensive mode, or at least the defendant bears the burden of proof, and the plaintiff can sit back and see if the defendant can carry that burden. So it may be there was some dispute over exactly the way the judge phrased the instruction, and that's how the plaintiff thought the appeal was going to go. How did the appeal turn out? Okay, and then they get to the Supreme Court. What's the Supreme Court's take on this case? The Supreme Court says we don't think this case is about negligence. Therefore, all the instructions about res ipsa and the way you phrase it and so forth is beside the point. We think the defendant is subject to strict liability. Why? What did the defendant do that took them out of the rule of reasonable care and now subjects them to strict liability? Okay. So the Supreme Court says there is such a thing as strict liability for conducting an abnormally dangerous activity. That's sort of the first proposition, is to say part of our tort law, while, you know, most of the time we're concerned about whether or not the defendant was negligent, whether the defendant was negligent or not is the key question in most cases. In some cases, we apply a rule of strict liability, and one of those categories of strict liability is where the defendant is engaged in, what's the phrase again? An abnormally dangerous activity. Now, obviously, we need to know more about this, what you mean by calling something an abnormally dangerous activity, but by what authority does the court first announce that there is such a thing as strict liability for abnormally dangerous activities? Whether this falls into it is a subsidiary question. The first question is, who says there is strict liability for abnormally dangerous activity? That's one source of authority. What is the restatement? What kind of an animal is that? Well, tell me a little bit about the restatement. What is it? Why is that an authority for the Washington Supreme Court? Is it like the Constitution? Is it like a previous case? Is it like a statute suggested by whom? Who has the authority to suggest things to the Washington Supreme Court? Okay? There, it turns out, you may have heard, we've talked before, and you know, when reference to res ipsa, well, what is this restatement? Who's behind that? Who's in The Wizard of Oz, you know, pay no attention to that man behind the curtain over there. Where does this stuff come from, Mr. Clark? It's grounded in common law, but the people who actually write the restatement are a bunch of sort of self-appointed judges, scholars, practitioners in a group called the American Law Institute. And they meet on a periodic basis and review different areas of the law, and specialists in these areas, scholars who are well-respected in these different areas, and lawyers who practice in these areas, and judges who have a reputation as being learned and wise on such matters, they are nominated to, and this is sort of like an ongoing institute or whatever. In any event, these folks study existing laws, as Mr. Clark was saying. They look at the body of cases out there and try to sort of summarize or distill, synthesize a rule, a set of rules, with regard to points of contention. So there are restatements on different areas in the law. There's a restatement of torts, obviously. There's a restatement of contracts. There's a restatement of agency. I think I mentioned that before, that this idea of principal-agent relationships that we touched on with respect to vicarious liability, there's lots more to agency. There's a restatement of property. There's a restatement of judgments, which has the sort of civil procedure thing about how you enforce judgments. I think the American Law Institute launched what eventually became the Uniform Commercial Code. So, again, it's had a very significant influence, in part because it's viewed not as an advocacy group for one point of view or another, but essentially something which has the opportunity to kind of take the grand Olympian view of these points of law and then provide a summary guidance to courts like this. And the Washington Supreme Court laps it up. I mean, they can't get enough of this here to solve their problem, okay? Now, there's another source of authority, as it turns out. It isn't just this restatement out there, which has no power in the sense that a previous precedent has a kind of legally binding quality to it. The court actually does reference previous cases that have. There's a case decided in Washington, underground cable or whatever it was, Pacific Northwest Bell Telephone Company. They also refer to Fletcher versus Rylands, which we'll look at next time. So it's not as though it's just the restatement, but the restatement helps to sort of synthesize, again, a body of law. Okay, so again, the idea is there is such a thing as strict liability that applies to abnormally dangerous activities, and now inquiring minds want to know, how do we identify an abnormally dangerous activity? Okay. Now, actually, before these are all contained in Section 520. So we have this list, this list of factors. But before we get there, 519 actually says something important, which I don't want to overlook. What does Section 519 say that bears study here? It says there will be such a thing as strict liability for abnormally dangerous activities and, or however, What does that latter qualification mean? What bearing does that have, not necessarily in this case, but on other cases involving abnormally dangerous activities? If I, for example, am in the business of hauling gasoline, I'm subject to strict liability. Well, what if I killed somebody? I rear-ended somebody and I killed them. Related to it in what sense? Well, okay. The thing that makes it abnormally dangerous is its potential to catch fire or explode. If that doesn't happen, if it simply rolls over on somebody, I lose control of my tanker, it rolls over and squashes the occupants of the car like a bug, that doesn't trigger strict liability. I'm still potentially liable if the plaintiff can show I was negligent. But again, the non-abnormally dangerous results are subject to the rule of reasonable care. I'm only liable if I fail to exercise reasonable care. However, when the abnormally dangerous character of my activity erupts, I burn some, you know, the gasoline leaks out, catches fire, explodes, etc., then I'm subject to the rule of strict liability. Okay? So, again, it's an important qualification here. As you immediately, for example, on an exam, see, oh yes, here's somebody carrying around 10,000 gallons of gasoline or doing something else that would subject them potentially to a rule of strict liability. There's no liability unless it is the abnormally dangerous character that triggers the injury. Okay, now we're ready for those criteria in 520. And what are those again? Okay, the first question is, and I'll polarize the way I phrase these things to say this is what a finding in the way I phrased it helps the plaintiff. By contrast, if you can't affirm this statement, or in fact you would say the opposite, then that helps the defendant. Notice that these are not elements as we had in the definition of res ipsa. It isn't a case where you have to prove 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6, and if you fail any one of these, you're out. These are simply factors for the court to consider, and you can see the way in which some of them are very heavily weighted on one side, some are kind of, a toss-up either way. We're not keeping score exactly. We're looking for a kind of gestalt, as it were, a kind of pattern or a sort of aha experience to say, yes, this is an abnormally dangerous activity, or no, it's not. Okay, the first factor, again, is degree of risk. And, of course, the plaintiff would like to show that it has a high degree of risk. And by contrast, the defendant would like to show the opposite. Okay, in high degree of risk, we mean the likelihood that sooner or later bad things are going to happen. If you carry gasoline around long enough, and you're in traffic, and you're using equipment that eventually breaks down or has flaws in it or whatever, eventually something like this is bound to happen. To the extent that's true, that helps the plaintiff show this is an abnormally dangerous activity. Second factor. Okay, what happens if the harm, let's see, I meant to put this in a polarized form here, high gravity of risk. Of harm, actually. In other words, this isn't like, trying to remember, is it the I think it's the Verizon ad where the real estate agent is walking around. She steps on the rake, and the rake flies up and whacks her in the head. You know, when this bad thing happens, it isn't like that. This is whole city blocks, you know, are incinerated. You know, a freeway overpass, steel girders are melted, looking like, you know, Play-Doh or something. This is a massive catastrophe. So, again, to the extent you can say that, as distinguished from, yeah, something bad happens, it falls over, it squashes something, etc. Okay, third factor. Okay, through. Yes, the question is, again, the plaintiff would like to say reasonable care can't eliminate the risk. Obviously, reasonable care reduces the risk. The more we check the equipment out, the more we train our drivers in defensive driving, the more we do this and do that, pick our routes so that we're avoiding heavily congested areas, etc. The more we do that, we reduce, but we'll never be able to eliminate the risk. There's always this residual potential for somebody else to do something stupid or for some earthquake or landslide or what have you to cause the explosion. Okay, what else? Okay. And again, tanker trucks would, I saw one in the last week. I pulled up next to one at an intersection. They're not like, you know, weapons grade plutonium or something that is so uncommon that you've never seen it. It's not as common as trucks. I mean, an 18-wheeler is not is a relatively common thing. The 10, 15, 20% of the vehicles on the road are large commercial 18-wheeler trucks. So it's not as common as that. It's not as uncommon as some other more exotic things. It's somewhere in between. What else do we want to say if you're the plaintiff? Okay, and again, this is almost a kind of reverse question for the defendant. That is, if the defendant can show something is really kind of belongs in a particular spot, it favors the defendant. So when I was first entered the teaching racket, I moved to Oklahoma, and where we lived, the closest grocery store had an oil derrick in the parking lot. You know, the old caterpillars, you know, bobbing their noses up and down, pumping oil. There were oil rigs in front of the Capitol. Now, you know, if this were natural gas or some other, you know, more volatile chemical. If it's kind of everywhere you go, or, for example, in an industrial area where there are chemicals and, you know, dangerous things sort of everywhere you look, you could say something is not abnormally dangerous if that's kind of the part of town or the area where we put those kinds of things. So in that location, it kind of fits. It doesn't stick out like a sore thumb, as 10,000 gallons of gasoline would stick out in the parking lot here. So, again, the question is, how strongly can we affirm that statement for the plaintiff? In this case, the tankers are on I-5, kind of a normal place for them to be, not inappropriate to where they were. What about the last criterion? Yeah, low social value. Now, again, this is almost working a kind of negative for the, it's a factor to consider as sort of an offset for the defendant. Strict liability might be less desirable for us if the effect of applying strict liability would be to restrict our access to something very important. If by putting the cost of gasoline spills onto the people who carry gasoline, if that would raise the price of, would double the price of gasoline, reduce our mobility, then the court might say, that kind of impact is not necessarily good public policy. Sure, we want to reduce the accidents that occur from this activity. Sure, we'd like to see plaintiffs who are injured get compensation, but we don't want to take away, again, by switching the rule from one of reasonable care to one of strict liability, we don't want to eliminate something that really has a very high social value. Now, if we went through these factors here, how would you respond? In other words, which ones would you give a plus for the plaintiff or a minus, representing one that would favor the defendant, a zero being neutral here? Does 10,000 gallons of gasoline create a high degree of risk? Yeah, that's kind of a no-brainer. High gravity of harm, again, you know, that's maybe two plus marks here. This is it's hard to imagine something more potentially hazardous. Can reasonable care eliminate the risk? No, really can't. Is it uncommon? I'm not sure I'd really, again, as between things that are very uncommon and those things that are extremely common, it's sort of a wash here. Is it inappropriate to the area? No. Does it have low social value? Quite the contrary. We couldn't function without cheap, plentiful gasoline. Mr. Johnson? Yes. Yes. Because the plaintiff would argue, in effect, why should the defendant be able to burden society with something that we don't really need? By contrast, if the defendant says, you know, how far are you going to get without gasoline? You shouldn't, you know, don't bite the hand that feeds you here. We're willing to be held responsible when our negligence causes an injury, but, you know, people carry around milk, 10,000 gallons of milk, they're not subjected to strict liability. Why should I be? And again, that's why these other factors are saying, but, you know, 10,000 gallons of milk can't, you know, explode and incinerate a city block. So I'm not sure I'd want to be underneath 10,000 gallons of milk either, but that's another story. Okay. All right, so the court looks at these factors and says, again, in this sort of gestalt way of saying, well, gee, is this activity abnormally dangerous? The answer is, well, yeah, it is. Therefore, we're going to impose strict liability. Now, there are two other opinions in the case here. Rossellini's in agreement that in this case liability should be imposed, but Rossellini doesn't want to let the case sit as the majority has written it out. He's got another issue he wants to express himself about. What's Rossellini's pitch? Now, let's be clear about the situation that Rossellini has in mind. I think what Rossellini is talking about here is a situation in which, as I had drawn there, before I erased it. The tanker truck's driving down the highway and minding his own business. There's a passenger car in the lane next to him, suddenly sees, oh, that's my exit, cuts in front of the driver, he slams on his brakes, loses control, accident happens, plaintiff over here, the Carol House character in our story, gets fried by the fire. Rossellini says that in a case like that, what should happen? Okay, no longer would the tanker truck be subjected to strict liability. Why not? Do you get any sense from Rossellini as to why he thinks there's a distinction to be made? Why not? I mean, from the standpoint that you get in your rig in the morning and the majority tells you, you're doing something socially valuable in transporting this gasoline, but bear in mind, you do so under a rule that says you're strictly liable if this activity results in harm. Now, whether it's a negligent driver or a landslide or a herd of deer or whatever that causes you to lose control of your rig, regardless, you're going to be strictly liable for the harm. But Rossellini says, no. Why not? What difference does that make? You mean it wasn't the... But that's true if it's a deer. There's no negligence on the part of the driver of a bunch of deer, you know, and he slips on the deer puree and, you know, slides across the highway and... Because we're not talking about negligence. We're saying you're strictly liable because you got in your rig and decided to transport gasoline. Ms. Collier, were you trying to jump in? But again, why does it make a difference if I hit a bunch of deer or I hit a negligent third party, a human being, as opposed to a herd of deer that causes the problem? That's what the majority says, but Rossellini says, no, it makes a difference to me that it happens as a result of some non-human source versus it happens because of a human's negligence. Mr. Liebman? What difference does that make? Yeah, I think that's where Rossellini is going. That he says, I'm okay with strict liability, but sort of, you know, my last resort. It's either this or the plaintiff goes uncompensated. But in the scenario that he has in mind of this negligent third party, he would say to the plaintiff, you don't need the tanker truck as a defendant. You can go after this negligent third party. That's how you'll get compensated. And then I don't really want to apply strict liability because I'm only doing it because I kind of have, you know, I'm trying to just solve a problem here, and if I don't have the problem, I'm not going to invoke strict liability to solve the problem. Why, Ms. Wisely, do you think the plaintiff or plaintiffs as a class would be unhappy with Rossellini's rule? Hasn't Rossellini figured out a way to get plaintiffs compensated in that case? Right, and particularly where you have these, you know, catastrophes of biblical proportions, you may not be satisfied with the insurance coverage or assets of the negligent third party. So Rossellini is essentially saying, in effect, I hope this person would be able to satisfy you, but he's in effect creating a distinct possibility that it won't. And from the majority standpoint, the defendant's choice to engage in this abnormally dangerous activity carries with it the responsibility for compensating the people who get hurt, as between them and the negligent third party. They're welcome to sort that part of it out, but just so we're clear on where this goes, we get to this issue in Chapter 6. Chapter 6 on multiple tortfeasors looks at those situations where the plaintiff is injured by two defendants, Defendant 1 and Defendant 2. They both cause the plaintiff's injury, as in Rossellini's hypothetical, and then we need to begin to formulate rules. Well, how do we allocate fault? What happens to the rule of joint and several liability? Do we want to have people responsible when someone else can't pay? How is this all going to work out? And because there are no easy answers to that question, there's a whole chapter 6, devoted to it. It turns out to be a very important issue. Defendants are not only interested in whether they will be found liable, but the extent of their liability. If I go out to have lunch with some friends, it makes a big difference to me whether I'm just paying for my cheeseburger and Diet Coke or whether I'm picking up the tab for the whole table. So, again, that issue, the particularities, once these defendants are held responsible, how they sort it out, is an issue for Chapter 6. But again, the majority says liability is triggered by the activity, and it really doesn't matter what the source or what the other sources are triggering the accident. Rossellini, by contrast, would restrict the rule to say, if I got nobody else to pick on, I'll take the guy conducting the abnormally dangerous activity, but if I get somebody else to pick on, count me out. Mr. Lieben, were you trying to get in earlier? Mr. Clark? Okay. What is the purpose of strict liability? Well, now, remember that in 519, are you questioning in Section 519 the qualification to say running over a kid on a bicycle doesn't subject you to strict liability, whereas the tanker spilling the gasoline and having it erupt in flames? Yeah. Right. Right. But remember, when I squash the kid on a bicycle, I'm not subjected to strict liability. So it does apply sometimes and not others. You don't find that screwy, do you? But Rossellini's is screwy because... Well, I'm trying to agree with you here that he is screwy, in my humble opinion, because the majority thought similarly that it shouldn't make any difference to the plaintiff. The plaintiff should not be disfavored in essence because the accident was also caused by a negligent third party, whether it's a result of running into a bunch of deer or running into a negligent third party. As far as the plaintiff is concerned, so long as the harm is the very thing that strict liability was set up to take account of, you chose to engage in this risky activity, you accept the financial responsibility that goes along with it. Well, the majority thought similarly, again, that the rule ought to apply more generally. Now, there's another opinion in the case. Justice Neal. What's his pitch? Why wasn't the failure to impose strict liability an error by the trial judge? The plaintiff didn't argue it. That's Justice Neal. I mean, he's kind of going, hello, isn't this an appellate court? Don't appellate courts limit themselves to the theories advanced by the disappointed party at trial? If they fail to advance a theory, we can't suddenly make it up for them. We can only correct errors which they pointed out and asked the trial judge to do correctly the first time around. What's the majority's answer to that? Do they say, well, we recognize Justice Neal's complaint, but we think in this case, they don't even say anything. There's nothing in the majority opinion that explains why Justice Neal isn't right in his complaint. I happen to agree with the majority on the substance once they get to it, but I can't help having some sympathy with Justice Neal in saying, please, majority, explain to me why you're not following your rules of appellate procedure here. It's kind of not, you know, we're 0-2 in the Washington Supreme Court here as far as basic procedure. And again, you may like the outcome, but the question is, how do you go about making these kinds of decisions, and are you following the rules that you've set up? Questions about Sigler versus Kuhlman or strict liability in general? Mr. Johnson? Okay. Well, but when we call something an abnormally dangerous activity, we are explaining what differentiates it from dangerous activities. So if I pull up next to another passenger car as I'm driving down the freeway, that other car and I are imposing upon one another reciprocal risks. If something happens, there's a, you know, the truck in front of me drops a, you know, something out of it, and I hit this object in my swerve over and smash into the guy next to me, or vice versa, we impose reciprocal risks upon one another, and for that the rule of reasonable care seems to work just fine. However, what Fletcher is suggesting is that where the risks are non-reciprocal, I pull up next to this, you know, tanker full of 10,000 gallons of gasoline. Yeah, I could cause him a little bit of harm, but more likely he'd just squash me like a bug. And he can fry me at 200 yards with what's in his, you know, that we're not playing in the same ballpark here. Now, what about pedestrians in cars? Does it make sense that we would say, as between an automobile driver and a pedestrian, that's a non-reciprocal risk, and therefore people who drive cars should be strictly liable for accidents caused to pedestrians? True? No, it's not the law, in part because, again, we're talking about things that are abnormally dangerous, and cars couldn't be more normal, or so we red-blooded Americans think. Amen. So, but that's, it's a good segue to talk about Fletcher versus Rylance, which we'll do tomorrow.